everybody. This is Kelly Mason and Leslie Carson, and you're listening to episode 2 of our Early Intervention podcast. We are currently recording this the day after the release of our first podcast, and it's been pretty intense. The last 24 hours, I've got agents calling me. TMZ is parked outside my house. At this point, I feel like Leslie and I need disguises. All kidding aside, we hope you enjoyed the first episode, and we know you're going to love our guest today, because you are probably wondering how we are going to talk about speech, language, and football. Well, let's get to it.
Episode 2, titled Speech, Language, and Football, is with our guest, Meredith Woodring. She's a speech-language pathologist at Infant Toddler Services serving Johnson County. Meredith has been working in early intervention for 24 years and plans to share information on speech and language. But before we bring Meredith on, hey, Kelly, tell me something good.
Tell me something good.
Okay, I just love this story. This is from June 2024, and it's a feel-good story about a girl named Macy, who is a 15-year-old high school freshman, and she has Down syndrome. Her mom says that she can count on one hand the amount of birthday parties she's been invited to since she started kindergarten. Recently, she got in the car and showed her mom an invitation to a birthday party for a friend at school. Her mom said that Macy's joy from the invitation is palpable and that it spoke to her of a longing that was fulfilled. The mom shared that you can hear her start to get choked up because her sweet girl is so elated to be included, and that it speaks to the common humanity that we all share. We all as humans want to feel like we belong. We all want to be wanted. Macy's mom hopes this story will inspire others to embrace those who are left out. Macy's mom says, we all have the opportunity to be the person to say, I'm going to create a space where everyone can belong.
That is a very touching and feel-good story, Kelly. And you're right. Everybody wants to feel like they belong and have a community. So as we move forward, let's make sure we're doing that, right?
Absolutely.
We're going to welcome Meredith. Thank you for joining us today to share information on speech and language disorders. It's been amazing that you've been in the field for 24 years. Can you share with the audience how you came into early intervention?
Yeah. Hi, Kelly and Leslie. Thanks so much for having me on your podcast. I feel so honored.
You should feel honored.
Well, 24 years in the field, that makes me feel old. So I started working as a speech-language pathologist in 2001 in the schools. I worked with early childhood students, so from the ages of 3 to 5, and then I also worked with elementary kids, grades kindergarten through 6th. I loved it. It was a great first job, and I learned a lot. And then in 2003, I added some part-time work with Infant Toddler Services for just a few hours a week. So back then, we were contractors, and we were kind of set up a little bit different. So we could kind of work as much or little as we wanted back then. So I would typically see about 3 to 4 speech kids a week after work on my way home from school. It was a really fun balance. And then in 2009, I left the school district when my daughter was born. I just wanted some more flexibility in my schedule. I dove into early intervention at that point and just fell in love with the birth to 3 population. So I've been working in early intervention since then.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. We have a variety of listeners here on our podcast. One of our first questions is, what's the difference between speech and language?
Yes, this is a great question because they're often lumped together, but they are completely different. Speech is the production of sounds. These are the building blocks of language. So speech refers to the sounds that make up the words. Whenever I think about speech, think about consonants and vowels. I also like to think of differentiate between sounds and noises. So again, sounds would be the consonants and vowels that you could assign a letter to. So if you could spell it out with letters, those would be sounds. And then noises are those other sounds that you couldn't spell, if that makes sense. If you think about like a snort for a pig sound, that would be what I would consider more of a noise because I couldn't spell that out unless a kiddo was saying oink. I could spell oink, but I couldn't really spell a snort. And I'm not going to snort for you.
Oh,
but
man,
you know
I
what
hoping,
I mean.
Darn.
We knew you were going to ask me, what does that sound, what does that noise sound like?
We all know.
Yes. And then language refers to the words in the vocabulary. Language can include not only spoken words, but also nonverbal language, gestures, social language behaviors. Nonverbal language could be like sign language or even using a gesture like waving at someone to say hello or goodbye. But we typically think about language being the words that we're counting. How many words does a kiddo have? That would be language.
Okay. Well, when we think about speech and language, what are some speech disorders that speech language pathologists might provide intervention for?
Yeah, some of the speech disorders that I see, one of them is called apraxia of speech. This is a motor speech planning disorder where there's a disconnect between what they want to say and what they're able to say. So I often will consider and kind of coach parents to think about, is this a can't or a won't when they're not saying words? So this would be a can't, like they are not able to produce those sounds. So this might look like a limited set of sounds they're able to produce, maybe distorted vowel sounds where you might see that they're like, if I would make an E sound and you could see my mouth kind of move out to the side, they might try an E and it kind of sounds like or something like that. It's not able to match. It can be an inconsistent production of words where words kind of change from one attempt to the next, where it's not always coming out the same. And then sometimes with apraxia of speech, we see groping for sounds where kids are just, you could almost see it in their face that they're trying so hard and those sounds aren't coming out. So that would be apraxia of speech. Another speech disorder is articulation disorder. So this would be, we see this a lot. This is kind of where kids are omitting sounds. They might have sound substitutions where they're using one sound instead of another. Sometimes kids will add in extra sounds. So that would be an articulation disorder that's considered speech. Another speech disorder is called a phonological disorder. This is where kids use something called phonological processes. So that basically is just a long fancy word or phrase that's referring to categories of sound errors. So this is where sometimes when I'm working with families, I'll say, okay, just, you know, stick with me. I'm going to get real speechy here. I'll kind of coach parents through this, but it is so cool. Once they understand, it makes so much sense and parents are able to identify. So phonological processes, again, those categories of sound errors could include initial, medial, or final consonant deletion. We see a lot of final consonant deletion in the two-year-old population. Fronting is another category of sound error. This is where kids are going to say a T or a D or a sound in the front of their mouth instead of the K and G that's produced in the back of their mouth. They might do something called stopping. This is where sounds like S, F, and SH that have continuous airflow. So where you have to kind of keep blowing air to sustain that sound. If they're stopping that airflow, they're going to say maybe like a P or a B or something like that instead, or a T. Cluster reduction is another phonological process. This typically looks like the S blends. So all those words that have an S plus another consonant next to it. So like spider, kids will usually say piter for spider, or tar for star, or nake for snake. And then backing would be another phonological process, which is a little bit more atypical, where kids are, instead of using sounds in the front of their mouth, they're using the sounds in the back. So yeah, those are some sound speech disorders.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. As we think about switching over to language, what is a language disorder that we might see in early intervention, or what does that look like?
Yeah. So language disorders could be receptive or expressive. So receptive would be where kids are having difficulty understanding vocabulary, difficulty with understanding concepts, sentences. A lot of times we'll see where kids aren't following directions or they don't understand those basic kind of routine directions. So that would be a receptive language disorder. And then an expressive language disorder could include difficulty using vocabulary or just that
a slow to develop vocabulary, which we often see in that birth to three population, or it might be not putting sentences or phrases together. And then as kids get older, we might see an expressive language disorder look like kind of getting into the grammar and the structure of language, maybe their syntax or their word order. So those are kind of some expressive language disorders. And then another expressive language disorder could, again, kind of tying that social piece in, it could be difficulty using language socially to engage with others. So not being able to take social cues from others, maybe missing social words that we say to greet others or to start a conversation. I know a lot of times I hear parents say that, you know, they're at the park or they're in some social situation and their kiddo, you know, kind of follows other kids around or they watch them and, you know, they're up on the slide and they don't have those words to talk about my turn, your turn, or they just don't really know how to say hi, you know, want to play, those kinds of things. Asking and answering questions is a part of social language that can also be an impairment. And then as kids get a little bit older, staying on topic and maintaining conversation to be able to have that back and forth turn taking to sustain conversation is part of what a social language disorder would be.
So it's very hard for me to stay on topic, but I'm going to. Thinking about the ages of birth and three, what is more important, speech or language, or are they equally important?
Well, I think they're equally important, but the focus tends to change as kids develop. So sometimes I'll kind of show parents a visual kind of with my hand. If you think about kind of a scale, like the balance of kind of one going up and one going down, that's kind of how I think of it in terms of importance. It's always important for caregivers to model language. So we know a language-rich environment gives kids a model to build their vocabulary and sound system. So in infancy, usually around 4 months old, babies will start cooing and babbling and making sounds. So this would be a time when babies are developing their speech sounds or a phonetic repertoire, kind of a library of sounds. I feel like in infancy, you might kind of start with the focus just on sounds. This is where we're kind of looking at babies and we've got that face-to-face where we're just kind of making nonsense, kind of silly sounds, you know, seeing if they can repeat those sounds. And then that's kind of where kids will start to do, you know, ba, ba, ma, ma, da, da, just getting sounds out. So once they've got those sounds established around 12 months, then I feel like the focus kind of turns to language. So this is where we would see signs and first words start coming. And at this stage, we aren't worried about sound errors. We're just trying to get the words out. So this focus on language is just, let's just get the words. And I always tell parents that if it's consistent and meaningful, we're going to count it as a word. I feel like this can get kind of muddy. This is a very tricky time where a lot of times parents will say, well, they said, they'll give me an example of a sound error, and they said this for this, but they didn't say it correctly, and they think that's not a word. So that's not the case at all. If it is consistent and meaningful, we're going to count it. And then as kids get closer to two, we would expect about 50 words and starting to put two words together into phrases. So articulation errors might be present at this stage. So the focus might switch back to speech. So I feel like it kind of ebbs and flows as communication skills develop.
That's great information for parents and others who are not speech language pathologists, kind of that timeline of knowing sound development, language development, all of that. Yeah. Well, you mentioned modeling language. And one of the questions we were thinking about is, if a child is not imitating words or sounds that you've been talking about, what strategies do you use to build that imitation?
Yeah. So if those first words aren't coming, sign language is a great place to start. I like to talk to parents about what's important to their child. So their favorite people, their favorite foods and toys, et cetera. And I picture the child as the nucleus in the center. And then if we think about just kind of drawing a, you know, just a little circle around them, what are their most favorite things? These are the words or signs that I would start with. And if kids aren't motivated by a thing, they won't want to talk about it. So we can model social gestures like waving or blowing a kiss or imitating actions in play. We know that imitation of actions is a developmental skill that typically comes in before imitating sounds. I think this is hard because a lot of times parents just, you know, they want them to talk. I mean, every parent tells me that. I just want them to talk. But if they're not able to show us that they understand the concept of imitation. They're just not ready for that yet. And that's okay. But I like to use the strategy where, like in books, so pairing an action with a word or a silly sound on a page. So this could be like, if there's a picture of a door, we're going to knock on the door and we're going to go knock, knock, knock. And even if the kiddo doesn't imitate the word knock, 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 and those words after me, if they're just knocking with their hand or their knuckles on the page, that's showing me that they understand imitation and they're participating in a way that they know how. If there was a picture, let's say in a book of a teddy bear, I would just tickle the teddy bear and I might pair it with, tickle, 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 something silly like that. Or if there was a dog, I might pet the dog and see if the kiddo could kind of imitate my action of petting the dog. Sometimes in books, you'll see, like stairs or a ladder, and I would use my fingers and go up, 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 and kind of climb up with my fingers so they can see that. So whether they're going to imitate up, up, up the words or just use their fingers, again, they're still participating. Or sometimes you'll see like a picture of a park scene in a book and there's a slide and I might take my hand and fingers on the slide and just pretend like my fingers are sliding and say, "Wee." So using those exclamatory sounds can be really fun. And that can be a way that kids can kind of start to imitate with some silly sounds. Like, we hear that a lot as, some of the first words that kids say, or boom, or wow. Whoa. So we often say those words with a silly voice. I'm sure both of you have probably heard me say this to parents before, but I always talk about using your voice as a neon yellow highlighter to say those words. Yes,
I've used that before. And the Charlie Brown reference.
Oh, yes, yes. The other words we say, exactly. So the way that we're speaking right now would sound to a kiddo like the Charlie Brown teacher. Wah, 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 wah. I hope it's not boring like that to our listeners, but...
Well, no, it's not.
A little more exciting than that. But if we were to use our voice as a neon yellow highlighter, we're going to get those kids' attention and they're probably going to be more likely to want to imitate what we're saying.
So instead of like, maybe like ball.
Yes, yes. Okay. And yes, exactly. You got it.
Lots of intonation and making it fun is key, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
So I know I've had lots of parents with concerns about using sign language because they do fear it will impede their child's progress with spoken language. Have you had these same concerns from parents? And if so, how do you navigate that or share information on signing with parents?
Oh, yes. This is a common question and concern of parents for sure. I would say parents who are verbal without hearing loss themselves are generally going to have verbal children. So modeling signs to kids when they're young will help build their language system and teach them that communication is meaningful and powerful. Using signs can get them what they want, it can decrease their frustration, and it increases their vocabulary. So again, when I was talking about nonverbal language, kids can still have, and we count those as words, kids can have an extensive vocabulary that they're able to sign. And at that time, while they're practicing those signs, waiting for their sounds to come in, they are building their language system, whether we can hear it being spoken or not. And then when they're ready to add speech sounds, they will. Think of sign language as a bridge to verbal communication.
Are there any resources or tools you use to offer to parents to assist with the development of speech or language? Or what resources have you found the most success with?
I mentioned the book activity before. I don't know if that's necessarily an outside resource or tool, but it's just kind of more of a strategy that I use. So again, kind of using silly sounds paired with actions to bring the page to life, like splash or shh, or a snake in a picture. I also like to model finger plays in songs with families. I guess a resource here would be the beloved Miss Rachel might be something that a lot of families are familiar with. She does a lot of modeling of this, but I think trying to take kind of what she does with finger plays and songs and encourage parents to be the ones to do this with their kids. So even if they're not ready to sing the words, they can still participate by copying the actions, like in Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. We all know the actions to that, or Wheels on the Bus, or Itsy Bitsy Spider. when kids show us those actions, or it's really fun when they can kind of predict, or they get to choose, you know, the action that they want you to sing next. So if we're doing Wheels on the Bus, sometimes kids might put their finger by their mouth for the shh, 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 you know, and they want you to sing that part. So they're still able to participate, and they're imitating, and then they're getting that language model at the same time. And then after this becomes routine and the child is enjoying the social time with their caregiver, the parent can pause at the end of the line and wait to see if the child will gesture or make a sound that they want that to continue. And then to check for understanding of imitation in general, I like to see if kids will imitate their parent doing just kind of normal household activities like cleaning or sweeping or mopping or wiping down the counter or the table or something. Another common check for imitation that a lot of providers do while playing is, you know, to put a block on top of their head and just, you know, be really silly and kind of go, ah, boom, and it falls off their head. And it's cool to see kids just pick up a block and then they put it on their head. And it's then I know, okay, they understand imitation in general. So then we can kind of build on that.
Yeah. And I think it can be difficult to understand, like, why is it so important that my child does this? And I sometimes use the story of like, okay, think about if you're in a workout class and there's a teacher in the front of the class, you know, and she's lifting weights or doing whatever it is she's doing. Like, you have to be able to watch her and know what you're supposed to do in order to follow along. You know, that's as an adult what we see, but as children get older, they need to be able to look around the room in school and see, what are my peers doing? That's imitation.
Yeah, that's a great example. That's so true, Kelly. We still need to do that as adults.
Yeah, I was thinking about the grapevine, like when people are at the front of the room doing the grapevine, which I could never do, but that's the word I was looking
for. Yeah, you're taking
that's
it
like
back
to old school class. Right there, right there. Yep.
Leslie did the Roger Rabbit in the office the other day. You'll have to ask to see that.
Yeah, I about hurt myself, but yeah, I sure did it.
I'll see if I can imitate it next time. Show me.
What role does intelligibility play in communication for infants and toddlers?
Well, first, I want to actually clarify what intelligibility means. I want to clarify because intelligibility sounds like intelligence, but it's not. So we know it's not, but just to make sure that listeners understand that, it doesn't have anything to do with how smart a kid is. It basically means understandability. I think that's just harder to say. And we call it intelligibility. So how well a communication partner understands what the other person is saying. So we typically talk about intelligibility in percentages at this age. You know, a general rule of thumb is understanding 50% of what a kiddo says at 2, 75% at 3, and 100% at 4 years old. So not meaning that sounds need to be perfect at age 4, just that listeners understand. Like I mentioned earlier, I don't really consider this an area to be concerned about until kids have enough consistent language. Most kids under the age of 2 also won't really tolerate articulation as a focus in play. So they seem to think, I already said it, now let's move on. Sometimes kids will use jargon or filler sounds that kind of muddy what they're trying to say. This is a normal part of speech sound development, but we want that to decrease as real words increase. So as they start to develop more real words in their language, we want that jargon and kind of those extra sounds to decrease. Other kids using sound substitutions or other error patterns that might make their speech difficult to understand. And many of these sound errors are age appropriate under the age of 3.
That's really great information to be able to share with our listeners, but also with parents who may have questions about intelligibility and I can't understand my child and my child's getting frustrated, giving them that information and those tools to know what to expect at what age in terms of intelligibility is helpful, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know I get that question a lot. Hopefully that helps.
Yeah. What do you like best about going into homes and working with children birth to 3 and their caregivers?
I actually like thinking on my feet and not necessarily knowing what I'm walking into. We do make a plan at the end of the previous visit to pick a routine to work on when we meet next. It doesn't always go as planned when we're working with toddlers, so I just try to go with it. I tell families on our very first visit that I want them to do what they would normally do at that time. I'm just going to be alongside them to model strategies and look for ways that we can kind of just tweak their routine. So I like finding ways to incorporate communication into whatever is happening at that time. Sometimes it's hard, but communication opportunities are really embedded into every routine.
I can't believe toddlers don't do what we want them to do all the time. I mean, that is just mind-blowing.
I know, right?
They want to do what they want to do.
Absolutely.
So that kind of leads into the next question. What do you think is the most challenging about working in the birth to three population and going into homes?
Yeah, well, kind of going back to that articulation again, but I really think articulation is one of the hardest areas of communication to work on in the home or daycare settings. I think a lot of speech therapists in our agency would probably agree. It can be challenging to find opportunities to practice a particular sound or what motivates a kiddo enough where they want to practice that sound. But although it may be challenging, I really enjoy it. The challenging thing is when parents have priorities that might not line up with age-appropriate development. Parents may want their kiddo to work on letters and numbers when they don't have a core vocabulary yet for those basic things in their environment. I just try to gently educate parents on functional outcomes that might help them understand what would be most helpful to them to make their routines easier. Being able to identify letters is not going to help mealtime go smoother if they're not able to tell what snack they want. So another challenging thing I can think of is kind of just homes that are really quiet. I'm a talker and, you know, I don't have a problem carrying on a conversation.
What? You're a
talker? I know. But sometimes narrating what's happening during the day can feel kind of weird for parents, and it doesn't come naturally to a lot of people. So I think that this is sometimes can just stretch parents kind of outside of their own comfort zones. I try to model, again, using a silly voice and play and encourage parents to repeat words over and over. And I always tell parents that if they feel crazy saying the same words so many times, they're doing it right.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you know as a provider when you need to bring in another team member to support you?
Well, sometimes after I've been working with a family for a while, I'll start to notice that progress is kind of slow, or there might be something else that's impeding language for improving. So this might be a situation where a kiddo is really driven by motor movement or has a hard time sitting still for a more structured language activity. And in that case, I would ask my team for support, might bring in an occupational therapist, for example, for a joint visit to help with calming activities or ask for strategies to help with their sensory system. It might also be where a kiddo is pre-linguistic and, you know, parents just want their kids to talk. So there might be some skills that they're kind of missing that kind of might come before they're ready to talk. So I'll ask another provider to come help me with play. Kelly and I have done this a lot together. If kids aren't sure what to do with their toys yet, it's hard to use those toys to elicit language or speech sounds. And then occasionally, a same discipline provider will go out for a joint visit when we just feel stuck. And we don't do this very often, but it is really fun when, you know, I'll go with another speech pathologist or another speech pathologist will come with me. And it can just be really helpful to have another set of eyes and ears from a colleague. Leslie and I have had this example as well with each other since we're both speech language pathologists. It can really help just give a new perspective or even just validate what we've already been working on. So our team of providers is so strong and so smart. There's so much knowledge to pull from each other. I'm just really thankful for that.
Yes, I am too. Yep.
I would agree with you, Meredith. It's nice when you can have the same discipline or another speech pathologist if you're feeling stuck to say, yeah, you're right on track, or give some ideas or strategies on how to help move forward.
Yes.
Okay. This is the moment everyone has been waiting for. How do we tie speech and language to football? Well, Miss Meredith is how we do that. Meredith, can you share with us a bit about what it was like growing up with a dad who played in the NFL?
Yes. Well, I wasn't sure how speech, language, and football went together. It doesn't sound like those three things go together, but I guess with me, they do. Yeah. So my dad played football at Kansas State, and then he went on to play in the NFL for 15 years. So my childhood looked a little different. He played for two different teams. So I got to go to a lot of the games. He played for the Houston Oilers and then the Green Bay Packers. We would go to home games, and it was just kind of funny being a kid in elementary school and going to school on Mondays and, you know, having kids in my class
everyone would have watched the game the day before and coming to school and talking about it. Kids would give me random football cards to take home and sign.
Did you follow through? Did you follow through?
I did.
Okay.
I did. I think one time I even had a boy in probably, I don't know, fourth grade or something, third or fourth grade, write me a note, and he folded it in between my dad's football cards. So my dad's football cards were on the front and the back, and his note was like in between. Well, I remember.
Did you have to like circle something inside the note? Like, do you like me? Yes or no?
I don't remember that. There's just things that I didn't think were, I didn't know any different. So they just seemed normal to me. But now, you know, as I've gotten older and I see it now being, that was kind of different. You know, people waiting, fans waiting outside of the stadium for us to walk to our car after a game, and people circling our car with pieces of paper and trying to stick it in the window for my dad to sign an autograph.
So this is what I'm like, Leslie and I are going through now with this podcast. I mean, so I'm glad we can talk with you about it.
Watch, like,
you
know, right,
you can shed some light.
Yeah. Well, Meredith, I know you guys have a really fun like family tradition that you do every year. Could you talk with us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we always try to go up to a Packer game in Green Bay as a family and watch the game. It's fun to go up there and experience it again as an adult and just watch the game with my dad. And before COVID, they kind of changed some of the regulations, but we used to be able to go down on the field. And one of the trainers was, I don't know if he's still there today, but he was, you know, a few years ago, one of the trainers that used to wrap my dad's ankles before the games was still there. And we went down on the field and my dad was like, oh, hey. And it's just funny.
That's really fun. It's really fun. And you guys just talk about speech and language like while you're there the whole time at the game, right?
Definitely.
Everybody, I just want you to know that Meredith's first name is on Wikipedia. We all know who they're talking about when they mention her, but I do feel cool knowing someone whose first name is on Wikipedia. Thank you, Meredith, for being our guest on the Early Intervention Podcast. We enjoyed having you. As we wrap up our time together, is there a tip or strategy you would want to leave providers and families with, or any advice for the Chiefs so we can win another Super Bowl?
I don't know if I can help the Chiefs, but I will say this is another phrase that you've probably both heard me say. I use it a lot. It's really simple, but your kid will say what you say, but they won't say what you don't say.
That's a good one.
Yep. So basically, just keep modeling the language. And if there's something you really want your kiddo to say, those words need to be modeled over and over and over.
That's awesome. As part of our podcast, we want to highlight someone or something as it relates to early intervention by giving them a shout out. Today, our shout out goes to dietitians and social workers in early intervention. Leslie, Meredith, did you know that March is National Nutrition and Social Worker Appreciation Month? We want to give a shout out to all the dietitians who support infants and toddlers' growth and nutrition, which impacts a child's overall development. We also want to give a shout out to social workers for their role in providing emotional support that is unique to each family's situation, as well as support to early intervention team members.
Well, that's a wrap on episode 2 of the Early Intervention Podcast. We hope you enjoyed our guest. Our next episode, we're going to be speaking with the famous dietitian, Dana Weber. She's been working in early intervention for 21 years. And Kelly, she's going to answer the question we've all been wondering about, but are they pooping? Look for episode 2 to drop on April 1st, and you can listen to the Early Intervention Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Music. Please be sure to follow us. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you're interested in hearing about, email us at earlyinterventionpodcast@gmail.com.
We also just want to send a thank you to Friends of Infant Toddler Services for their support with this podcast. Friends of Infant Toddler Services, we often call them FITS. They help develop, maintain, and fund additional services and programs for children served by Infant Toddler Services of Kansas serving Johnson County. They are funded through private donations, fundraising events such as the annual Fall Ball Gala and Tee Off for Tots golf tournament, and through various grants. You can learn more about their work by visiting the Infant Toddler Services of Johnson County website, itsjc.org. it is time to say goodbye.
Thank you, Kelly, for being a great co-host. Until next time.
Thanks for having me.